91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we examine long-term care insurance, which is designed to give later years health benefits to individuals. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Attorney Stephen Dunn is our guest. Long-term care insurance came to be in the late 1980s. It's important to understand the policies, how they work, and how to navigate a claim. And more, Topical Currents literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez visits with writer Thane Rosenbaum. His latest novel is set in Miami Beach during the summer of 1972, when the island community hosted both political conventions. The book title echoes the famous line of Jackie Gleason from his Miami Beach national TV show, "Ah, how sweet it is." Stay with us, Topical Currents, next after the news. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, Tuesday edition. Well, this hour we look into options and issues for long-term care insurance.
It's a realm of insurance which needs special awareness and knowledge, for it's possible for claims to be made on behalf of people who are unable to look out for themselves.
Or who may be too ill to do so. Our guest is attorney Stephen Dunn, who's litigated cases concerning long-term care, and he's with us now in the studio. Welcome to you, Stephen Dunn.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. I think we should begin with just a little brief primer on long-term care insurance, a little of the history of it, and a little of the larger issues that surround it.
Sure. Well, long-term care insurance is a relatively new insurance vehicle. And when I say new, probably the very late 80s, early 90s, insurance companies began to sell these long-term care insurance policies. And the whole concept behind long-term care insurance was to help defray the cost that someone would incur when they reach the point in time of their life when they need some assistance at home with what we call activities of daily living. So those activities would include bathing, dressing, feeding, ambulation, transferring, things like that. And also these policies would cover somebody with a cognitive impairment if they require supervision to protect themselves against harm to themselves or others. So that's the basic, those are the basic things that are covered.
Is that both physical and mental, or mental mistakes, maybe like checkbooks and forgetfulness?
Absolutely. So as people decline cognitively, they may be physically intact and able to do all the things that we do every day, like bathing and dressing,
right,
and so forth. But because of their poor judgment and their diminishing judgment, they need prompting. They need perhaps somebody to look after them to make sure that they don't wander, or that they don't leave the stove on, or any number of
things. Or avoid being swindled or something like that.
Or avoid being swindled, yes.
Well, let me ask you, what do you recommend? We're going to get into the issues that you deal with, but do you recommend that one has, because there are those who say no, don't get long-term health insurance, and those who say yes, definitely get it. And at what age do you think we should be getting it, because it gets more expensive as you get older?
Well, I have it. Once I got into this field of law, I realized a lot of things that I never understood or took for granted, and that is that we do.
Well, about how old are you?
Well, me right now, I'm 57, soon
okay.
to be 57.
Right.
So I bought my insurance probably when I turned 50. I think people should have it. I think it's an important part of planning for the eventualities of aging. So that's what I did.
And when can people get it? How young can you get it?
Oh, as young as, if you can pay the premiums, doesn't matter how old you are. I believe you could probably do better if you buy it when you're younger, because you're paying in over a longer period of time, and perhaps, and I'm not an expert at, you know, the sales and marketing of long-term care insurance policies, but I think the younger you are, the better your mortality is, and perhaps the pricing is better.
Right.
But But I would recommend to the listeners to consult with experts in that.
I want to take into consideration family medical histories.
Well, they do now. I mean, now, let me back up. Previously, when these policies were issued, the underwriting was very, very loose. Just about anybody was issued a long-term care policy. And I think because of that, the long-term care insurance companies have run into a lot of problems because they did not expect people to be living as long as they did.
Right.
And, you know, people are living with chronic illnesses. And so they use their policies over a long period of time. Now, my understanding is that there is a much more rigid underwriting protocol that people have to go through in order to qualify to receive that insurance.
Who regulates this?
Well, these are insurance contracts, so they're...
So are they regulated by the state of Florida in Florida?
Correct, yes.
So what happens if a New Yorker buys a long-term care insurance policy in New York or Massachusetts or whatever and ends up retiring here? Who regulates it then, Florida or where they got it?
Well, it's a great question. First of all, they are portable, these policies. So somebody can, and we have that quite a lot in Florida. We know that people retire to Florida.
Exactly.
In droves. So I've handled many, many cases involving people who've come from the Northeast or wherever with their policies. And so there's a legal concept called conflict of laws. And that deals with what law should apply to a contract that was issued in New York when the insured person has now taken up residence in the state of Florida.
Right.
And it becomes a question of competing interests. Now you have that person who is a resident of Florida. So the courts will ask the question, which state has the greater interest in protecting the rights of that individual, the state where the policy was issued, where that person is no longer a resident, or the state in which that person now resides.
Okay.
So the Florida courts will typically and should apply Florida law to that contract, even if that contract was issued
and do
in
they?
Another state. And they do.
Well, until preparing for the program, I'd never considered the simple fact of what you call this catch-22 that is so inherent with these long-term care insurance policies. So would you explain what that catch-22 is here? Yeah.
Well, in what context?
Okay, so you need it when you get older. But when you get older, you do have the cognitive impairment or whatever, so that you can't figure out what you have. So so you say Florida law has kind of stepped in here to help resolve that.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of catch-22s in these scenarios. You have, first of all, you have people who buy these policies and don't really understand what they bought from the beginning.
Right.
And you know, I'm guilty of the same thing. You have all these different insurances that you buy, and how seriously do we really study what we buy? How much do we really understand about what we have and what covers us and what doesn't? Unfortunately, it's not until a loss occurs that we come to realize what we do have and, what's worse, what we don't have. So, you know, a lot of people who bought these policies did not understand what they had. So, for example, my own father, he had purchased a policy in the mid-90s that was called a home care-only policy. And I remember asking my father when he bought it, because we worked together as lawyers.
You were attorneys together, right?
We were attorneys together. And I remember when this gentleman came by and was selling to my father, and I asked my father what it was, and he said, well, this is long-term care insurance. And I said, well, what is that? And he said, well, this will cover me if I need to have somebody take care of me as I get older. And I remember saying to him, well, you're not going to need that because my sister, you know, Nancy and I will take care of you. And he gave me a nice smile, and he went ahead and bought the policy. And not because he didn't trust us, but he didn't want to be a burden on his children.
Right.
So, but when it came time for him to use the policy, he could not live in an independent residence because of his cognitive deficits and problems. So he had to go into assisted living. Well, the policy does not specifically cover assisted living. And I'm sure that he, a lawyer and a sophisticated man, really did not understand that at the time that he bought it. So that's when my first long-term care case began. And what we were struggling with is, why shouldn't this home care policy cover our father in assisted living? Because assisted living really is his new residence.
Well, I guess common sense is not in play, because obviously what's the difference between whether you need care in assisted living or at home?
The only difference is the place where it's being what you call the place where it's being provided.
Right. So did you win the case?
We did.
Okay. The other catch-22 that I'd read about was, because when people get older, sometimes their policies lapse because they don't have the cognitive awareness to write the premium check, or so somehow it gets unpaid. So the policy lapses, and then they don't have it. And now is when they need it. So the state of Florida evidently has done something to rectify that.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a law in place, and the law is pretty smart in this regard. And it's specific to the long-term care insurance statutes. And basically, it's called the unintended lapse, or the unintentional lapse of a long-term care insurance policy. And the law basically says, like this: if an individual allows their policy to lapse due to a cognitive and or a functional impairment,
right,
then that person can have their policy reinstated. So it's a great law, and believe me, I've had to use it many times to get people back, you know, get their policy back.
So if somebody's listening right now, for example, or someone who's caretaking for somebody who had a policy that lapsed, what can they do? How do they go about getting it
reinstated? Well, first of all, they have to request it, and a lot of times the insurance companies, what they will do is they will require individuals to meet their underwriting standards, as opposed to following the statute that requires that the policy be reinstated, so long as the insured and the insured's family can establish that indeed there was a cognitive and or functional impairment at the time of the lapse. So they would have to pursue it, and they should do it very quickly. But I will add something else. There's a mechanism in the law that also requires the insurance companies to offer to the insured to designate a third-party addressee to receive important notices and notifications, such as a child or a power of attorney or whatever, so that they can monitor what's happening. And if something unusual is going on with that policy, they can intervene and prevent a lapse.
When did the law go into effect?
Oh, it's been in effect for quite a few years now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay. We're speaking with attorney Stephen Dunn, and we're speaking about long-term health insurance and some of the pitfalls on Topical Currents. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Our topic is long-term care insurance with attorney Stephen Dunn. Stephen, let's talk a little bit about, we were talking about that you might have to have a third party to be involved in this. Shouldn't that be your designated personal representative, and to have a living will so that would be taken care of as soon as that person is deemed to be incapacitated, either mentally or physically?
Well, I think I'm sorry.
Wouldn't that be the healthcare surrogate, though?
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Same thing.
Yeah, but for the purposes of the long-term care lapse issue, the insured can designate anyone they want without having any other formal documents in place. So if you tell your insurance company, I want my son or my daughter or my friend or whatever to get notices, then...
But if you didn't, could your health surrogate then take that up with the insurance company as your representative?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
One of the things we were talking about also before the show was about how it's often not just the insurance companies that are at fault. It would be the provider who says, you need 8 hours a day of assistance. And so they deplete their policy, you were saying, and don't even realize they're doing it. And in fact, maybe they only needed 2 hours a day.
That's another potential catch-22 where the person, the insured person, needs care. And the question is, how much care do they need? There are providers that have been accused of over-utilizing. And that is not a good thing because, a provider owes a duty to the person they're providing care to, almost like a fiduciary relationship.
Right.
So when they're recommending a level of care to their client who happens to have an insurance policy, it has to be really what they need and not more than they need. And so there's a problem out there and then there's a potential conflict of interest, because if somebody has an insurance policy that provides a daily benefit of $200 a day, that doesn't mean that the care should add up to $200 a day. It should add up to what the person needs.
Right.
So the policy should not drive the quantum of care that somebody needs.
Okay, so if you have $200 a day up to that, is it lengthened if you don't use the $200 a day? Do you have more care at the end?
It depends. So there are policies are issued with durations or with buckets of money. So if it's for a duration, then it really doesn't, you're not depleting the policy any faster.
So it's X number of years.
X number of years. So you're not depleting the policy if you use up the daily benefit every day. But if you have a bucket of money and you've got a $200 a day policy, you can do the math. If you're using $200 a day
right.
versus $100 a day, you're going to deplete the policy twice as fast. And that's where the insured person really needs to be made to understand that component, that if you get this much care, you're going to deplete your policy at this rate so make sure you know you need this care before you accept it, because you do have to economize so that you can stretch out your dollars to get care over the long term.
So your dad was an attorney, obviously sophisticated mentally, and you're saying he didn't understand his policy. So how is the average layperson with that arcane language written into that insurance policy supposed to understand it?
It's not easy.
And so what did they do?
And you know, it's what's funny. I don't know if it's funny or not, but the insurance companies don't necessarily understand their policies either. Because when you have to have the courts step in and rewrite an insurance policy that was written with ambiguities in it, that tells me that somebody did not understand that policy when they issued it. And that happens a lot.
How is it determined by whom and by what standards a person is deemed incapacitated to have the insurance kick in?
Well, yeah, go ahead.
Sure. Well, on the functional side, a person has to require the assistance of two or more of the activities of daily living. So if somebody needs assistance with bathing and dressing, that would be enough to trigger benefits under the policy. And the cognitive impairment, if that's what is triggering the need for care, has to be significant enough such that the person needs prompting and cueing and supervision to protect that person from harm to him or herself or others. So basically what happens is, to initiate a claim, a licensed healthcare practitioner would come in and assess the individual functionally and or cognitively, and then prepare what is called a plan of care to accommodate those needs. And then that would be submitted to the insurance company, and then the care would be provided pursuant to the plan of care. And then you've got, the issue of whether the insurance company wants to come in and verify the need themselves. So they might send their own person in to do an assessment, and or they might just do a telephone assessment of the individual, which I personally find extremely objectionable, especially
right.
when you're dealing with somebody with a cognitive impairment or even a functional impairment, because who wants to admit on the phone to a stranger that they need help in the bathroom or they need help getting dressed? People don't admit that. So you get a nice person on the end of the phone calling Mrs. Jones and say, Mrs. Jones, I'm from XYZ Insurance Company. How are you doing today? Oh, I'm doing marvelous. Thank you for asking. And who are you? You sound like a nice young person. And that's how the conversation goes. So with that with that telephone conversation, I frequently see insurance companies not approving claims. So it's a big problem as far as I'm concerned.
And I'm thinking also that it's not just for the elderly, though. I mean, what if a young person who has long-term health insurance breaks, has to get a hip replacement or a knee replacement or whatever? Can they get the, can that kick in then?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But I find that with younger people, there's even a higher degree of scrutiny by the insurance companies, which is fine. You know, they're entitled to scrutinize claims because they're being asked to pay for them. I don't have a problem with scrutiny, but, you know, oftentimes they'll do surveillance on people just to make sure that they're doing or not doing what they say they can or cannot do.
But if a young person has a hip replacement and requires maybe a month to be functioning again, is that considered long-term care?
Well, I don't think it's considered necessarily long-term care, but it would be covered under a long-term care policy.
Right. So getting back to the scrutiny, is that legal? You know, in the surveillance, is that legal?
Well, I mean, they have a right to do that. They can survey, and a lot of times they'll take medical records and sort of parse through medical records to pull out a word here and a word there and, you know, wordsmith a lot and things like that. Because, you know, when you go to the doctor, you're not telling the doctor about your day 24/7. You know, when you go to the doctor says, how you doing? I'm doing fine. It's not, well, I'm doing fine, except I'm getting bathing and dressing and, you know, I'm getting help being fed. So a lot of times there's a disconnect between what's in the medical records and the reality on the ground. And a lot of times that will form the basis for some kind of a defense by the insurance companies. So we always have to deal with that as well.
So insurance companies are obviously, I mean, we don't want to make them into all bad guys, but they are in the business of making money.
There has to be checks against fraudulent claims, of course.
Right.
Absolutely. And absolutely.
It would be easy to scam.
Well, look, if you're 85 years old and you need some help bathing and dressing.
Well, I'm talking more about younger people.
Yeah, younger people. Look, there is fraud. And fraud kills it for everybody.
Right.
It's cheating. It's not right. You should not ask somebody to pay for something that you don't need. But you should have someone pay for what you do need if you bought coverage for that. And you shouldn't have to jump through multiple hoops to get what you're entitled to.
Stephen, could you give us some contact information? I mean, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, if they do have an issue, could you provide that for
Absolutely.
Us?
Absolutely. My office is in Bay Harbor Islands here in Miami, and my office number is 305-868-1400. And I do have a website. It's called the long-term care insurance.com. And anything else?
That's
no,
it.
That's
well,
good.
We certainly want to thank you, Attorney Stephen Dunn. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez is next with novelist Thane Rosenbaum.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you. Thane Rosenbaum's new novel, How Sweet It Is, takes place in 1972, the year Miami Beach hosted both presidential conventions. Muhammad Ali, Jackie Gleason, and gangster Meyer Lansky, all of whom appear in the novel, could be seen walking the streets. Hotels, bars, and diners, now consigned to local history, were still active. Witnessing the hustle and bustle are the Posner family, two Holocaust survivors, and their 12-year-old son, who still have to cope with the legacy of a horrible past. When not writing fiction, Rosenbaum teaches law at Fordham and NYU. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Rosenbaum about his novel, How Sweet It Is. He asked him why he believes 1972 marked the beginning of the end of an era for Miami Beach.
Well, Ariel, by 1972 on Miami Beach, the city was fading. The early period of the sort of the heyday of hotels and tourism which ran through the 1950s and the 1960s, was really coming to an end. The hotels were becoming more decrepit and run down. People were not vacationing in Miami Beach in the way that they were. The counterculture was in full swing, and it changed sort of the tempo of the country, and Miami Beach just seemed too slow and not racy or exciting enough. It had grown older in many ways, not just the building, but the people. It started to be associated with sort of elderly Jews, retirees, snowbirds. That wasn't so true so much in the 1950s and 60s, when the hotels would be hosting Sammy Davis Jr. and Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin. And although that was still happening at some of the larger hotels, overall, everyone started to see a city in decline, which is one of the reasons, Ariel, why there was some talk about trying to bring gambling to Miami Beach as a way to revive the city. And that's, of course, how Meyer Lansky comes into the novel and was very much present during that era, because after losing all of his hotels to Castro with the end of that revolution, and with his gaming interest no longer really existing in Las Vegas, he was looking for another place to become a powerhouse. And he was hoping that there would be gambling on the East Coast. What he didn't realize is that the Floridians weren't going to have it, and that eventually Atlantic City would. And so he never really participated after that in terms of the world that he once knew as a gaming maestro. That ended with Castro nationalizing those hotels.
Meyer Lansky is one of several historical figures in your novel. Your model for this novel was E.O. Doctorow's Ragtime.
Exactly.
How was that an influence?
Well, you know, I knew Edgar. He just died recently, but I was very friendly with him, and I was asked years ago to interview him for a documentary that they were doing on the great Jewish writers of the world. And they interviewed the great Jewish writers, and they had a sort of a younger, lesser-known writer. That was me in the Doctorow interview. And I was asked to interview him, and in doing so, it was a 10-hour interview that they filmed. I think it's owned by now Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And when I reread Ragtime, I realized that I had something I had always warehoused in my mind, this very strange thing about 1972 in Miami Beach, which was that because of the political conventions, both the Democratic and Republican conventions were both hosted that summer in 1972, which was just weeks after the Watergate break-in. Because Jackie Gleason had just been taken off the air, and he was sort of basically bumming around looking for a second chance. Frank Sinatra had just retired his first time and spent some time with Jackie Gleason, basically drinking and eating in Miami Beach. Muhammad Ali was in Miami Beach training with Angelo Dundee. He had just lost his comeback fight to Frazier, and there was hope that there would be a second Joe Frazier fight. And he was training in Miami Beach. You could see him running on the beach. You could see him running around the high school. Isaac Bashevis Singer was at Surfside. He was still about half a dozen years away from winning a Nobel Prize for Literature. Everyone was here for different reasons, mostly for a second chance. And I always thought, you know, that's just so strange. That's such an amazing coincidence. What a colorful city with all these incredibly, you know, evocative, interesting historical characters. And when I reread Ragtime, I realized I finally figured out what I wanted to do with these fictional ideas that I had warehoused, which is, why don't I make Miami Beach the center of a novel? Let it be the character, the time and the place, a year in the life of a city in which these incredible historical characters interact with each other, put together by a family, like in Ragtime, mother, father, boy, and in this novel, similarly, the Posner family, Sophie, Jacob, and Adam, around which all of these other characters pivot. So it's sort of a homage in many ways to Ragtime. I would call it's Ragtime for Jewish Southern Floridians.
We're speaking with Thane Rosenbaum about his new novel, How Sweet It Is, which is set in Miami Beach in 1972. You mentioned Isaac Bashevis Singer. His portrait is not flattering in your novel. There's a quote I'd like to just read. Because at one point, Jacob, who is the father of this family, this fictional family, he's a Holocaust survivor, as is his wife, Sophie. And he meets Singer and kind of tells him things about his life. And Singer just writes it down. And here's what the narrator says. Here, of course, Ibe failed to acknowledge how he was cashing in on another's suffering. mining his mind, the petty thefts of the fiction writer. But isn't that what all fiction writers do? Isn't that what you do?
Yes, exactly. The difference was that Singer was notorious for creating Jewish experiences that were unflattering. You know, and he was criticized for it among Jewish intellectuals, which was that, you know, his books were racier. You know, they showed Jews in unflattering lights. They were more deviant. They were more sexualized, especially the refugee community. So where we think now of Holocaust survivors as a kind of a sacred group of, you know, these people that somehow miraculously were saved from Hitler's ovens, Singer, you know, treated them in Enemies, a Love Story. You know, you start to see survivors surviving in a different kind of way. And so, yes, it's true that what he did isn't unlike what other fiction writers did, but I think that he did it with a community of refugees that people thought were vulnerable. And he saw them in a different light. And also, you know, here was the one Yiddish writer that the world knew. And what was being translated were many, very, very many sexualized, scandalous novels.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever read Cynthia Ozick's story, Envy.
It's one of my favorites, Yiddish in America.
It's about an I.B. Singer-like writer. And again, as we said, Yiddish writers did not like I.B. Singer. They thought of him as the Harold Robbins
Absolutely.
Of Yiddish literature.
Yeah, they loved.
I could not understand why people admired him so much.
Yeah, they could. They were shocked because, as the Cynthia Ozick story points out, one guy got translated. You know, it's as if they anointed one, thanks largely to Saul Bellow's intervention. But by the way, Singer became the only well-known Yiddish writer. And then Playboy magazine interviewed him. And then his career was reestablished in the United States. But he was writing in a dead language that was being translated into English. And Yiddish intellectuals, Jewish intellectuals, resented that he was the anointed one.
But you say that he portrayed Jews in a deviant way. But one can argue, to play a devil's advocate, that he was portraying them realistically.
Yes.
It was as human beings. And again, we're back to the whole Philip Roth argument.
Absolutely right.
Where, you know how the rabbis went after Roth in the 60s for his portraits in Goodbye Columbus and in Portnoy's Complaint.
And Roth loved it.
And Roth loved it. He fed off it. But again, where do you draw the line? Or is there a line to be drawn?
I don't. I mean, I think that what Singer did was completely appropriate. They are fictional. But yes, these characters existed in the culture. He didn't invent something that didn't already exist. There were Jews like this. And by the way, the survivors and the refugees were the canny ones. It shouldn't surprise anybody, right? The ones that survived, you know, many people noted the poets, the violinists, the philosophers, they're the ones that were killed in Auschwitz. Many of the people that survived were the more agile ones. And so what would you expect? They show up in the United States and they were going to be the more agile ones. They're going to be more cunning and they're going to be more conniving and more deviant and more hipper to the broader culture, to sort of know how to play the game. And Singer was notorious for both lampooning them and extolling them as here are the new Jews. But you can imagine the rabbis didn't love it. The only Jewish women loved it, by the way, because it freed them of the sexuality that you saw in the 1960s. It was as if it was a license for Jewish women to experience sex in the same way.
We're speaking with Thane Rosenbaum about his novel, How Sweet It Is. Well, talking about canny Jewish women, Sophie, who is the mother in your novel, she's quite a survivor and ferociously so, but she's a little crazy.
She's nuts.
And yet she eventually is hired by Meyer Lansky.
She becomes his chief lieutenant, the consigliere of the Jewish mafia.
In Miami Beach. And it's ruthless, rather ruthless.
She's ruthless. In the novel, she's portrayed as giving a new life to the Jewish mafia. They had become stale. They had lost their edge. And Meyer Lansky taps her as his lady consigliere. And she becomes, you know, a woman who survived Auschwitz, was a woman who knew how to survive and knew how to strategize and put together deals and knew how to be ruthless when necessary. And that's sort of the message that, you know, without Bugsy Siegel, Meyer Lansky was looking for another goon, somebody could help think through how to get rid of the other mobs and how to outthink them. And he relies on her in a very comedic way. And there's a message there that an Auschwitz survivor, a woman, in her second life, found a way to put together the lessons that she learned in her survival in Auschwitz.
Well, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Thane Rosenbaum. This is Errol Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Errol Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is novelist Thane Rosenbaum, whose new book, How Sweet It is set in Miami Beach in 1972. Thane, as you mentioned in the last segment, the Republican Democratic conventions took place in Miami Beach in 1972. And there was fear that what had happened in Chicago in 1968 would happen in Miami Beach. And of course, what happened in Chicago was a complete catastrophe. It was a riot. It was a police riot, as someone described it. How was the Miami Beach police chief able to keep that from happening?
Well, Ariel, the police chief, his name was Rocky Pomerantz. He's also in the novel, amid all of the other celebrities. And he was charged with this impossible task after the rioting against the anti-war movement in 1968. How could he host both conventions in a small town with only a couple hundred cops? Not only that, the city didn't want to have the kind of black eye that happened in Chicago with seeing teenage hippies having their heads pounded in by the police. So he cut a deal with the anti-war protesters, and he basically said to them, I will give you Flamingo Park, and you can camp out there, you can smoke pot there, you can sniff glue, you can take drugs, you can have orgies out there. I'll even open up the pool at night so you can skinny dip, but don't hassle delegates. And I'll build you a podium near the convention, but not at the convention. And you can get up on a podium, you can scream how you hate Nixon and how you hate the United States and how you hate, but don't hassle anyone in this suit. It was actually a brilliant idea. There were very few arrests. The park became literally a center field, was known for orgies. In the novel, I play with the comedy of that. But it was very well known that the hippies were having sex in the park. They were smoking pot. Apparently there were undercover cops in there just making sure how bad it got. But there were very, very few arrests. And Rocky Pomerantz was extolled as a hero for able to host. And remember, 72 was the real violence about the Vietnam War, because Richard Nixon had said he would end the war by the end of his first term, and he didn't. So that's why there was some real concern about what would happen. And remember, the Watergate break-in, Ariel, took place only 5 weeks before the convention. So we're talking about real political fervor and social upheavals at its very highest. And yet somehow Miami Beach squeaked by without drawing attention to itself for beating up on hippies and anti-war protesters.
Well, the Republicans were even planning dirty tricks at the Democratic convention.
Yes.
There was, I think, G. Gordon Liddy's bizarre plan. Was it called Operation Gemstone or something?
Yes.
Which was going to have prostitutes and
drugs.
I mean, that never happened.
No.
But...
And I fictionalized that idea. I fictionalized the idea that they try to do a Watergate 2 at the Octagon Hotel. The Octagon Hotel was the headquarters for the Democratic National Committee. And so you're quite right. There was some thought. I always jokingly say that, you know, now every scandal ends in gate. Monica Gate, Deflate Gate. But that's all because of Watergate. It would have ended in a gone if it was the Octagon. All these scandals would have been a gone, not a gate.
We're speaking with Thane Rosenbaum, whose new novel, How Sweet It is set in Miami Beach in 1972. There were some things I learned from your novel that were interesting. First, author Godfrey Road.
Yes.
Which, of course, is a very popular thoroughfare here. And yet it's named after someone who does not have a very good relationship with a certain demographic. So explain.
Yes, I mean, this is one of the great paradoxes of Miami Beach. 41st Street, which cuts straight in the middle, and you're quite right, is a major thoroughfare of Miami Beach, is Arthur Godfrey Road. In the 1940s and 1950s, Arthur Godfrey was radio's biggest performer and even had a television show as well. And he owned a hotel in Bell Harbor, the Kenilworth, that had a sign ubiquitously positioned that said, no Jews, blacks, or dogs are allowed. And it was one of the racially segregated, ethnically segregated, caninally segregated hotels. And so here you have a town, Miami Beach, widely associated with Jewish Americans and Holocaust survivors later, somehow honoring one of the United States' best known entertainer anti-Semites. There's a paradox there.
Well, another entertainer that plays a big role in your novel is Jackie Gleason.
Yes.
In fact, he opens the novel.
Yes. It's almost as if the reader is on the Jackie Gleason
show. Yes, he's like the unseen narrator.
Yeah, the unseen narrator who says, and away we go.
And people probably don't, there are some people who don't remember Jackie Gleason. And yeah, he was a pretty big star.
He was probably the biggest star in the United States in the 1960s. He had, of course, The Honeymooners, which was a very popular situation comedy. And then he had the biggest variety show before there was the Carol Burnett show. In the 1950s and 1960s was, the Ed Sullivan show, Milton Berle, Jack Benny. But Jackie Gleason had the biggest show. His variety show was the biggest in America. He was the highest paid television star for many years, more higher paid than even Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. And at some point in the 1960s, he decided to film the show, the variety show, live from Miami Beach. So Miami Beach became very famous on Saturday nights all around the country because the camera would start out in New York and you'd hear Jackie Gleason say, "Come on down." And the camera would go at high speed all the way down the Atlantic to the seawall of Miami Beach's Art Deco district. And for many, many years, people associated Jackie Gleason. He was the favorite son of Miami Beach. One of the world's great entertainers was filming live from 17th Street.
Because everybody, associates him with comedy, but he's also quite a very good dramatic star. The Hustler.
Minnesota Fats.
Yeah, that was a very good performance. Again, there's nothing funny about it. Very low key, very subdued, and yet has a lot of layers.
I think he had Academy Award either win or at least a nomination.
I think he might have had a nomination.
Yeah. I think I say in the novel that he was a five-tool player. I mean, he was a great dancer. He had records, mood music. You could buy Jackie Gleason records that he composed and conducted that were mood music for all sorts of occasions, big sellers in the 1960s. He was a comedian, both stand-up and sketch comedy. He was a dramatic actor. He was a tremendous dancer. He was very well known and, he was a very heavy man, gargantuan, but he was very well known to go, hang out with his buddy Sinatra, go to the Eden Rock or the Fountain Blue and pick up women to spin them around the dance floor. He was actually very well known as a ballroom dancer.
We're speaking with Thane Rosenbaum, whose new novel, How Sweet It Is set in Miami Beach in 1972. Thane, you're a law professor. You were a law professor for many years.
Still am.
Oh, you still are?
Yeah.
Okay. You write about the law because you've also written nonfiction books about the law. And there were two that caught my attention. First, it's Payback, The Case for Revenge, where you make an argument in favor of revenge, not in terms of vigilante justice. You're not in favor of vigilante justice. But you are, I think, and correct me if I'm not getting this right, you want to introduce more of the victim into the process.
Correct.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we have a legal system that doesn't care about victims. We care about laws that are broken. We don't care about the experience of the victims. They're always very marginalized. And revenge, the concept, ancient revenge, eye for an eye, lex talionis revenge, is really about satisfaction. That's why you hear in, the movies of revenge, I will have my satisfaction, right? The satisfaction of victims always mattered to make people even, to restore moral balance, to restore a sense of dignity, that what happens to victims and what's taken away from them, their dignity, sometimes their lives, sometimes a certain injury, a moral injury that's both physical and spiritual, a wound. And that the experience of that, it's very hard for me to understand how we're offering justice unless at the end of whatever the decree, whatever the legal judgment is, victims don't feel better. If victims don't feel better, it's not just. We ought to be concerned about how victims experience the legal system. And so, yes, I've always been an advocate as a human rights law professor on behalf of victims. And I simply wanted to reintroduce the idea of what vengeance means. It's not about blood. It's about accuracy and precision, that it matters that we restore a sense of dignity and that sense of loss that somehow gets compensated to victims, and our legal system doesn't do a very good job with that, and that's what I was trying to introduce. Vengeance does, And the legal system doesn't, and we need to introduce some of those emotional elements into the law.
Yes, but that's what I find perhaps a little troubling, when you introduce emotion into the law.
Yeah.
Because, it, you know, whenever you introduce emotion into something, then it can obviously get out of hand.
Yes.
Because I've always believed that there's a difference between justice and law. That there is justice, which is, again, the satisfaction you're talking about. But then there's law, because law is a system. It doesn't guarantee satisfaction. It simply tells you that this is a process that you can engage with to come to some sort of result, not necessarily to your satisfaction.
Right.
But it does establish order in society.
But Ariel, you know, people walk around all the time. They hear cases like the O.J. Simpson case or the Casey Anthony case or any kind of case or their own experiences. And they walk away and they shrug their shoulders and they say, there's no justice in the world. People say this all the time. And I think that's an unacceptable position. People should not be walking around paying their taxes to a legal system that doesn't let them walk away, not just the victims, but ordinary people, and have a sense of moral revulsion that what just happened doesn't feel just. That's really what I've been arguing. And also, we oftentimes conflate the law and justice. We treat justice and revenge as separate. Justice is what happens in courtrooms. Revenge is what happens when you let people run amok. And I say, no, it should be the same, that there's no justice unless victims feel avenged. And there's no revenge if it's not just. It can't be too much. It can't be excessive. That's what an eye for an eye means. Not more than an eye, but also not less than an eye. Which also makes you think that plea bargains aren't just, because anytime someone is being underpunished, that's not justice either.
Thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Thane Rosenbaum.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. We thank you for tuning in this hour. Our long-term care insurance segment was produced by Polly Landis, with technical direction today by Jason Zapka. Paul Leary is our online producer. Lead producer Richard Ives also gave assistance. Tune in for tomorrow's program, when we focus on the acclaimed Miami Music Project with both its founder, world-renowned conductor Maestro James Judd, and education director Stephen Liu. The Miami Music Project helps kids pursue their musical dreams with guidance from professional musicians. Bonnie Berman for Joseph Cooper. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.